We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer of Bleakley Advisory Group and editor of The Book Report. How are you today, Peter?
Good, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you like to break inflation down into two distinct categories, services inflation and goods inflation. Why is this distinction important, and what are we seeing in each of those?
Well, on the good side, we derive a huge amount of benefit from technology and production efficiency and the ability to, over time, to make more things with less. And that has kept a lid on goods prices. If you look out over the last 20 years, goods prices, ex food and energy, have averaged zero. Now, there are issues with CPI and hedonic adjustments, particularly to cars, for example, new cars. But putting that aside, the average pre-COVID, the 20 years into pre-COVID was zero. It was always the services side of the economy that reflected much more persistent price increases, with the largest component of the services component of CPI ex energy being shelter, call it housing. And they take housing and they turn it into rents. And rental growth has been rather persistent, higher medical care costs, insurance of all sorts, auto insurance, tuition. You send your kid to camp every single year, there's a price increase. You go to the movies every single year, there's a price increase. And so the 20 years leading into COVID, services inflation ex energy averaged 2.7%. You blend it together and you have overall, call it a 1.5 to 2% type inflation rate. So what we have now is, well, in 2020, we had services prices that deflated because of obviously what happened, where goods prices inflated. But now services prices are reaccelerating again. And I'll argue that they're going to reaccelerate to above trend, particularly with rents, considering where home prices are going. So the question really in this whole temporary or not inflation debate is, where do goods prices go from here? Do we just quickly revert back to sort of that zero trend that we saw beforehand, or is there something more here that is more sticky and longer lasting? And I'm of the belief that it is going to be longer lasting. And I'm not saying many, many, many years. I mean, inflation, at least on the good side, is typically cyclical. But I think we're in the middle of a cyclical rise in inflation that will surprise people in its persistency.
So, Peter, when we talk about these deflationary forces like technology, can we go over a couple of the ways that these deflationary forces bring prices down, and a couple of examples of them?
Well, I think technology is the best. I mean, take the PC. Rewind the clock to 1981 when IBM was the leader in personal computers, and they used the Microsoft software, and that was the it thing until other competitors came along. Well, if back then, current prices back then, or say the price back in 1981, was about $3,000 for that computer. Well, if you tacked on 2% inflation growth year after year, the price of that computer would be about $6,000. But the price of that computer now is much less than $3,000 for even greater computing power. You take a video game. I used to play Atari way back when. It was $150. And here we are. Many years later, and you can get a PlayStation or an Xbox for no more than that. So technology has dramatically lowered the price of things, but these companies have made it up in volume. And that's been, I think, a main example of what you're talking about. But still over time, I mean, prices go up. I don't want to sound like we're not going to see goods deflation, that we forever see no price gains in goods, because again, a hedonic adjustments artificially suppresses that. But you know, you get the point of how technology is an influence.
So in this vein, Peter, something I've been thinking about lately is let's say if we take the relative price level for commodities at this point in time, and we see that they're relatively low, let's just say, do you think that this aid of technology will help keep commodity prices down, or is there a cyclical nature to the, let's say, the commodities bull market as well?
Well, I think it's definitely cyclical. I mean, certainly technology helps an energy company get oil out of the ground or get gas. I mean, technology is what created the shale industry, essentially. Technology will make it easier to get copper out of the ground. But it still does not change the very cyclical nature of the underlying commodity. I mean, technology helps us do everything a little bit easier, but it still doesn't necessarily change the dynamics of one's business in terms of end market supply and demand. It just may make you as a producer more efficient in procuring your product, but the end selling price is still going to be at the whims of the marketplace.
Interesting. So something I have asked several guests on the show about is if they think that the CPI measurement is an accurate representation of inflation, or if the Fed is just trying to cherry pick this data.
Well, interesting. So I talked about hedonic adjustments with the good side of CPI. The Fed, we know, focuses more on the PCE as their favorite measure of inflation. That typically runs about 0.5% below CPI. My problem with PCE is that it undercounts housing relative to the average cost of housing for the person that for the household, particularly those that rent, and it takes the healthcare component and basically measures Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates. Well, we know Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates in the U.S. are price fixed; they're price fixed to as low as possible. So that's not really a good measure of healthcare costs. Whereas in CPIs is measuring out of pocket actual expenses on medical care. So I think yes, the Fed is relying and basing monetary policy on a flawed metric of inflation that is artificially suppressed because its biggest component, as I mentioned, is and they've literally run monetary policy on a flawed metric.
So, Peter, you've given us examples of, let's say, healthcare costs and tuition costs. Can you give us an example of where the free market works much better versus these government interventions and basically the outcome of each?
Well, technology, as I mentioned, is a great example of how free markets can do things more efficiently. In healthcare, let's take that for example. We know the government is the dominant payer in probably 70-75% of healthcare costs. But let's take LASIK. I got LASIK surgery maybe 15 years ago. That's pretty much private pay out of pocket. You're not calling your insurance company's not reimbursing you for LASIK. Well, where have LASIK prices gone over the past 15 years? They've gone straight down. And that is a medical service done by a doctor who went to med school, who is going to correct the vision in your eyes. And that price has gone down. I don't know of any other medical procedure that's reimbursed by third-party insurance and the government that can say the same thing.
And in a way, this is also tied, let's take tuitions, for example. If the government creates a big market and cheap loans, let's say, to be able to, for students to be able to pay for this education, these costs have gone nowhere but up, right?
Correct. Look what's happened to housing. We know there's been massive inflation there. Fannie and Freddie have obviously been a key part of that in terms of greasing the financing wheels and basically buying almost all mortgages that are out there. So yeah, because when the government subsidizes something, that artificially changes the supply-demand dynamic, and usually higher prices are a result of that.
So why is higher inflation matched with lower interest rates a bad combination and something you're watching out for, Peter?
Well, low interest rates didn't just fall to be low interest rates. You know, interest rates didn't just fall to be low interest rates. They were pushed. They were pinned, irrespective of where the inflation rate is. So we don't have a market, free market in the U.S. Treasury market or in many bond markets around the world, particularly in Europe, we have artificially set level of interest rates. Therefore, it's not reflecting what a true metric of inflation would be. It is reflecting what a bunch of people sitting around a table think that the right rate should be.
So in what way does higher inflation really handcuff the Fed?
So the Fed, just look at the last 13 years. Okay, so we're going back to right before 14 years, right before everything hit the fan with housing and their response to it of cutting rates to zero, initiating QE, and so on. And then QE2 and QE3 and QE4 and Operation Twist and just a bug that went around the world. When there is low inflation, central banks feel that they have license to do as they choose because they can get away with it. You know, any kid who can eat as much candy as he wants is going to keep on doing it as long as he gets away with it or she gets away with it. It's only until a parent comes along and says, no more, or we're going to limit how much you're going to eat. And that's the same with the Fed. They just keep doing things as long as they can get away with it. But once you get an inflationary situation, which we are in currently, where instead of having stable prices, we have unstable prices, well, inflation is kryptonite to a central bank because it handcuffs them. Not only does it limit their ability to act in the way they choose, but it also forces their hand to reverse some of the previous easing that they've had in place. And if they don't heed that call, well, then the market is going to do it for them. And if you look at the first 3 months of this year, with still a very uber dovish Fed, even though we had a vaccine, you know, the Fed had on COVID policy. Well, once you had the vaccine, well, we were the beginning of the end of COVID to a large extent. It still could be with us, obviously, for years, but to a large extent, we have it in control. But the Fed continued on. So the bond market said, well, I don't want you to run this economy hot. I don't want, as a bondholder, to preside over a depreciation of the value of my holding and have inflation eat away at my coupons. I'm going to adjust policy for you. And that's what happened in the first 3 months of the year when the 10-year yield went from 90 basis points to almost 180. The 5-year went from 35 basis points to north of 90. And only up until these past couple of days when the Fed finally got less dovish, and I emphasize less dovish because they're still uber dovish, did they finally make an attempt to get back in control of the inflation situation. And the markets obviously responded rather quickly. But even a 1.5 10-year, even though it's off the highs, is still up 60 basis points year to date. The 5-year, which spiked yesterday at 90 basis points, is obviously more than double where it started the year.
So in a way, this also really hamstrings them in reacting to let's say an equity market crash. If inflation is higher, they can't just print their way out of it and save the market too, right?
That gets to the handcuff analogy and it being kryptonite. It completely alters their ability to respond. Now, that is a problem globally with where the level of interest rates are, with interest rates being negative overseas and obviously zero in the US and other places, is that we are not, the bond market and level of interest rates is not set up and not positioned for a bout of persistent inflation. You know, if the Fed funds rate in the US was 2.5-3, if the 10-year yield was 4-5, well then yeah, we can, it's priced in a level of inflation that we can bear. But now there is no cushion there. And I like to say there is no shock absorber within the world's bond markets to a period of inflation that's more than just temporary.
So do these deficits even really matter anymore if we can just keep printing and paying off this debt?
Well, I think that they, in the US, they've begun to matter in terms of the value of the US dollar. You can draw the last 30 years a chart overlaying the dollar index, which of course is euro heavy. Half of it is the euro about, give or take, with the US budget deficit as a percent of GDP and the US trade deficit. And they pretty much mimic each other. So I do believe that the dollar, while it's not necessarily weak because it's off the lows of a couple of years ago, it certainly is well off the highs when you have central banks around the world that are much easier than the Fed. So particularly, you know, you look at the dollar action against the euro and the yen. So I do think it's beginning to be reflected in the dollar. Now, yes, until there's some dramatic move, politicians feel like they still have license to do whatever they want, as long as the cost of funding is really cheap. And there are no repercussions just yet. But just as the inflation story is kryptonite to the monetary side, it will be kryptonite as well and handcuff the fiscal side. And it could, because now you take the Biden administration and Janet Yellen, for example, who's obviously head of the Treasury, and they're beginning to now having to answer more questions about inflation. And I would not be surprised behind closed doors that they're getting, I don't want to say worried, but becoming more cognizant that they're out of control spending, and Republicans were out of control spenders too, that there's a limit to that with inflation now rising to the level that it is. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a connection between after passing the 1.9 or 1.8 trillion in March, that the Biden administration has backed off from the 4 to 6 that they want to spend in the next package. And now it's more just let's focus on, you know, actually hard asset infrastructure rather than anything else. And I would not be surprised, and obviously they're not going to come out and say it, that it, that partly has to do with the inflation numbers we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, as we're talking about this massive spending, how did the tether to a gold standard constrain the government? And can we point towards coming off the gold standard in 71 to the reason for the unbelievable debt we're seeing today?
I think there's no question about that. I think that's indisputable. I mean, what a gold standard does is just it creates some rules of the road. It creates, obviously, a limit to how much currency that you can print and create, because it has to be backed by gold in some fashion. Not necessarily one for one, but some sort of relationship. And you can't just pull gold out of the ground just like snapping your fingers. It's hard to get gold out of the ground. Just ask any minor executive how difficult that is. So it was a natural constraint. And we know as a politician that if there is constraint, they would be more prudent with how they spend their money. Just like someone who has a job may be more focused on how they spend their money as opposed to someone who's just sort of given a persistent allowance. Well, as long as the allowance keeps on coming in, they don't necessarily have to worry about saving and where that money goes, because it's always going to get refilled.
So after World War II, we saw the last massive spike in debt to GDP, somewhere around 119%, but it was brought down back to nearly 30%. And now we're actually at north of 127% or thereabouts. So is there any incentive to pay down the debt when interest rates are this low?
No, well, they'll never pay down the debt. It's either you grow GDP to lower the debt to GDP ratio, but the debt will always then just be refinanced. So the only hope is to grow faster than the rate of debt and have nominal GDP rise faster than the cost of your funding. Now, we always want to say, yeah, at some point this is going to matter, at some point. But I started hearing that in the 1980s, that we're expanding these budget deficits and the U.S. government's going to go bankrupt. As long as you have a printing press, you're never going to go bankrupt. But inflation is a form of default because people are getting back less in real money. And now we're in the middle of inflation, here's the perfect example.
Mm-hmm. So when we see an announcement like yesterday that the Fed is thinking about raising rates by 0.5% in 2 years' time, does this mean anything concrete?
No, it means absolutely nothing concrete. But we have to keep in mind that we likely have seen peak dovishness from the Fed. Because it wasn't just the dot plot, which I find somewhat irrelevant in terms of being a good gauge of what they end up doing. But they did talk about that they're going to be tapering at some point soon. So you don't go from dovish to hawkish. You go from uber dovish to being less uber dovish. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Fed did yesterday. And when you look at the markets and the economy and over the next 6 to 12 months and 24 months, well, what do you have to look forward to? You have a period of tightening of some sort. And there's no question it'll be glacial, just as the process was under Bernanke and Yellen, where it took them, well, it took Yellen because Bernanke had left, 6 years after the recession ended to finally raise interest rates. They were doing QE 4 years after the recession ended. For who knows what reasons, a lack of faith and the ability of the economy to grow on its own. But being less dovish, that's why you've had the market response. It's sort of a natural market response. There's the assumption that, okay, if we're going to go through a tightening cycle, whether it's tapering and or rate hikes, well, the economy slows, let's flatten the yield curve, sell commodities, sell cyclicals, buy the dollar on higher rates, and buy technology stocks because in a slow growth environment, they'll grow faster than others. That's the trade here. And it's sort of textbook. But I think when people realize that this is still going to be a very slow glacial process, I think they'll realize that the Fed is going to be well behind the curve for years to come.
You were mentioning that one of the reactions to this less dovish policy is to sell commodities. So why do we see the reaction in, for example, gold, like we saw for the last 2 days since this announcement was made?
Well, I think it's some of its positioning. You take the commodity sector in totality. Bank America early this week had their fund manager survey, and the commodity trade was the most crowded along with crypto. So I just think that the bull boat got pretty full on the commodity side. And what we're seeing here is a shakeout. Also, we know gold trades off the dollar and real rates, and real rates have gone up and the dollar has gone up. Therefore, every algo kicks in and sells gold and silver. But at some point, again, people are going to wake up and realize the Fed's going to be ultra slow in doing anything, that inflation is going to remain persistent, that these debts and deficits are only growing, and the dollar is going to eventually roll over again. And the bull case for gold and silver in particular is still very much intact, notwithstanding, you know, these hiccups that, you know, any gold investor knows is maddening, but part of the game.
So you were saying that Powell should have addressed some issues with the housing market. What do you think he missed there, Peter?
Well, if there's one sector of the U.S. economy that is the most sensitive to monetary policy and changes in interest rates, it's housing. What is more sensitive to the cost of money than someone buying a house? And here we have massive housing price inflation to the point where we are making it unaffordable all over again. Just when you think the Fed might have learned their lessons from the mid-2000s, they're doing it all over again. And that 12 to 13% home price increases really screws many wannabe buyers, particularly that first-time buyer, particularly that millennium buyer who wants to own a home. And to not have one question of Jay Powell at that press conference, not asking him what he thinks about the housing market, at the same time he's buying $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities every month and feeding more gas into that housing fire, you know, the hotness of the market is nuts to me. But in a way, he got away with it not being asked and not being confronted, because I don't know how, with a straight face, he can substantiate what's going on in housing and the damage he's doing to affordability.
So exactly in this vein that you're saying, Peter, of the damage that's being done to affordability, does too much stimulus in this case burn itself out?
Yes. You would never think that being too easy can actually slow the housing market down. Usually you think, okay, the only thing that slows the housing market down is higher interest rates and the Fed. Well, what we've learned is higher home prices ends up being its own break. And that what we're seeing in a lot of different markets is a stagflationary type situation, but most pronounced right now in housing, where, you know, the high cost of materials and labor, and from the buyer's standpoint, higher cost of the home is literally slowing down the pace of construction and the pace of transactions. So running things too hot, yes, eventually flames out. You do not want to run things hot. You want things to be steady, not hot.
So, Peter, what do you see as the biggest risks right now, either for the economy or the stock market?
It is clearly inflation, inflation, inflation. It mucks up everything if it is persistent. It mucks up monetary policy, as I mentioned. It leads to a rise in interest rates. It screws up the economy in terms of what it does to consumer spending. That won't see wages rise to the same extent as inflation does. So that reduces their standard of living, will reduce their desire to spend. It mucks up the supply chain. It makes things more unaffordable. It creates delays. It's a mess throughout the chain. So to me, it's all of that inflation, and that is the ultimate risk and black swan event if this is not so temporary.
How do you mean black swan event, Peter? Because if everybody's expecting more inflation, how can that be considered a black swan event?
Yeah, I mean it's not in the sense that it comes out of nowhere, but it does come out of nowhere if it's persistent. Mm-hmm. Most people still think that this is a transitory situation. Most people have been trained on 40 years of slowing rates of inflation. So a black swan event is not necessarily a 1970s type situation, but a persistency of a 1970s type situation, because no one expects it. Everyone's accustomed to, oh yeah, we have a little flare up in prices, it'll quickly go back down again. So that's the black swanish part of what I'm talking about is, yeah, we all see it, but there's only a select few that thinks that this is a regime change rather than just a cyclical thing that'll sort of flame out.
I've had a previous guest on the show, and he was saying that we shouldn't have seen certain situations as a black swan, more as a giant gray rhino coming.
Yeah, this would hurt if it ran into you. Mm-hmm.
So, what about the bond bubble as a risk, Peter? I know you've spoken about that before.
So I didn't check it today, but as of 2 days ago, the average high yield, according to the Barclays Index, was 3.8%. If you look back just over the last 20 years, 15 to 20 years, the average investment grade yield was 3.8%. If you want to buy a triple C credit because you want some extra yield, well, you're going to get a little less than 6% for a triple C credit. In other words, the credit right above going bankrupt. So and that's nothing compared to what the Europeans are dealing with or what the Japanese are dealing with. And when you think about negative interest rates, that's the epitome of a bubble, because you've turned an asset into a liability. You've turned an asset into the ultimate hot potato, where obviously the only way you make money is flipping it to somebody else that thinks it will go deeper negative. So that's the epitome of a bubble. But as we know, in all bubbles, they go on as long as they go on for. And that's why this inflation story, to circle back to that, is so important, because that bubble unwinds if we get a period of inflation that is longer lasting. I mean, let's just take the European situation where most of the negative yielding bonds reside. Just imagine what happens to that region's bond market if the ECB just goes back to zero interest rates from minus 50. Just go back to zero. That bond market blows up. So, And what would cause them to go back to zero? It would be persistent inflation and the Germans that would be finally saying enough is enough. They're not there yet. They're only talking about tapering the pandemic emergency purchase program. I mean, the emergency is in this program. Europe is not in an emergency, but they're continuing to conduct this emergency program. And Lagarde last week said they're going to continue to do it until next March. So, but maybe there will come a time when we don't have negative interest rates anymore, but there'll be a lot of pain in the world's bond markets during that process.
So in a way, the U.S. can just be relatively more hawkish than the ECB, and that could theoretically make things a little bit more rosy for the U.S.?
Well, I don't know about rosy, because the Fed's still going to be very late in hiking, and real rates will still be firmly negative here, just as they will in Europe. So on a real inflation adjusted basis, they actually can be more deeper negative in the US compared to Germany or other parts of Europe.
So if you were head of the Fed, Peter, what would the areas be that you would focus on to help bring the U.S. system back under control?
Well, to get into the weeds, I would immediately announce an end to the purchases of mortgage-backed securities. Let's start there. I would immediately start by saying we're going to start cutting QE by $20 billion a meeting. So I just gave you four meetings of notice that it's going to zero. Make your adjustment. And then, you know, ultimately, I don't want the Fed in the game of price fixing the cost of money in any way. But, you know, that's not going to happen. So if I was still left with sort of the joystick of where to move rates after QE ended or soon when QE would end, I would say that we're going to start slowly raising interest rates. And what I think is important here is that the Fed and all central banks have taken this all or none approach. They're either dramatically easing or they're in a hiking cycle. There's no in between. There's no sort of ups and downs. If it was a market-driven interest rate world where it would be up and down. You know, the one thing about the markets is, yeah, markets get things wrong, but it quickly adjusts when it realizes that. Where central banks are just, you know, institutional establishment bureaucrats, and they don't respond to anything quickly at all. So I would try to sort of train the market and letting them know that interest rates go up and they go down. And it doesn't have to be years of one way and years of the other way. It can be going up and down per meeting based on maybe some rule book of growth and inflation expectations.
Yeah, so these small cyclical corrections shouldn't be ever considered something as being bad, but rather just correcting for something that the market could have possibly gotten wrong.
Correct. The markets are a great self-correcting mechanism if left to its own devices. But as we know, they're not left to their own devices.
So rather than take a little bit of temporary pain, we've been just fed more and more currency creation. And it just makes me wonder how this all ends, Peter. Like, how does it just come in one big dramatic correction, or does it just grind? Do you think it could just keep grinding lower?
Well, it all depends on how the inflation story plays out. You know, it's easy to say all this will end badly. How do you go on like this and have it end well? There's no free lunch. I get that, and I agree, but trying to figure out how it unfolds and the timing and whether it's death by a thousand cuts or, you know, it's sort of a big event, I don't know. I think at least in the beginning, if this inflation story, again, remains sticky, it will initially be death by a thousand cuts. And then it'll become something, you know, more profound. Because, you know, getting to a point I made earlier about, you know, the Fed and feeling like with there's low inflation, they have license to do what they want. If there's inflation, that would force them to do things not on their own timing and be forced to maybe taper faster than they have blueprinted and maybe raise interest rates quicker than they want to, with obvious negative implications both to the economy and markets if they had to do that faster than they want to. But that's why they're playing this very dangerous game of chicken with this whole inflationary type story, because the Fed needs to taper and raise rates irrespective of whether this is temporary or not. Because there's nothing that speaks to a policy that is so extreme relative to the world that we're in right now. So they're going to be, again, tapering and raising rates anyway. The problem is that the transitory or not then ends up determining the pace and the timing of that. If they want the pace and the timing to be on their own volition, well, get your arms around this inflation story. Because if you don't, that pace and timing will be forced upon you.
So if it is forced upon them, Peter, and inflation really persists and becomes hotter than they want it to be, do you think they're going to be able to control it and bring it back to a manageable level?
Not for a while, because there's no one there that has the guts to do that. there's no Paul Volcker anymore that would be able to withstand the political pressure to reside over a recession because they felt that that was medicine that needed to be taken. Jay Powell's term ends in February. He either has said, you know what, I'm done with this job. But if he's done with the job, he doesn't want to preside over a downturn before he leaves. And if he wants the job, he wants another term, well, he wants to get reappointed and he's not going to want a downturn ahead of that. So it is for those political reasons that it would be extraordinarily difficult for the Fed to get ahead of this. And that's why the market will end up, I believe, mugging them with reality in the quarters to come with the inflation prints that we're going to see.
Yeah, I think it always comes back to incentives. And as you just laid out, there's two incentives that are, let's say, orthogonal to real solutions for the markets. Peter, as Chief Investment Officer of Bleakley Advisors Group, Advisory Group, can you share with us some of your strategies that you employ to try and offset some of this destruction of your purchasing power or even grow your wealth?
So we have client portfolios, and then there are two strategies that I specifically run, two portfolios that are within that broader portfolio. One is a global macro, one is an income-focused strategy. We know in a world of low interest rates and you have retirees and you have people living off income, I've created a product that I believe will provide them with a diversified form of income via stock, dividend-paying stocks, bonds, and preferreds. On the global macro side, which is more dynamic and is can own a bunch of different things, I certainly have my gold and silver allocation. I own my commodity stocks. I own my treasury inflation protected bonds. I own emerging market bonds because it's the only part of the world where you can get yield. And I do own value stocks, and I own a bunch of international markets and stocks there. I do think when you look at over the next 10 years that the outperformance is going to be in mostly in Asia and stocks in Europe after 10 years of dramatic underperformance. And U.S. technology stocks, great companies, great businesses, dominant. But from a valuation perspective, I think it's your turn to underperform relative to other parts of the market. So I'm very bullish on emerging Asia. I have exposure there through country ETFs, but also individual companies that do business there. And also when I'm a value investor, so when I try to find opportunities, the opportunity is just finding myself in parts of Europe, just based on the cheapness of certain markets and dividend yields that you can get, that I just find in the US, it's just getting more and more difficult to find those cheap opportunities and lower risk opportunities.
Excellent, Peter. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we wrap up here?
I try to be open-minded to how well this plays out. I'm in the camp that inflation is here with the most intense pressures we've seen since the 1970s, and it's not just going to go away like many people think. But I'm open-minded. If I find that I'm wrong, I will switch. And I think that investors need to feel that same way. And on the investing side, I do think it's important, as I mentioned, that it's getting harder and harder to make money in markets. And I think you have to be more creative. You have to look outside the U.S. and you have to have a time horizon because there are going to be a lot more bumps in the road, I believe, in the next couple of years than we've seen, outside of COVID, of course, which was its own unique situation compared to, the years prior to that.
Excellent, Peter. If anybody wants to find more from you, your website is Book Report, B-O-O-C-K, report.com. And also you're available on Twitter, P Bookvar, B-O-O-C-K-V-A-R. Anywhere else you'd like to point people towards?
Yeah. And if they're interested in wealth management services, they can check out our website at bleakley.com.
Perfect. Thanks so much for your time today, Peter.
Thanks, Tom. That was fun.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.